This week on the Back Table Podcast.
We basically were a two-year fellowship, so one thing is that we weren't as appealing to U.S. graduates. They'd already thought they'd spent plenty of time in training, and spending another 2 years really didn't match a lot of their plans. But the foreign graduates were more than happy to come and spend 2 years with us. And what we realized as we started doing this is that when we returned our fellowship graduates back to their native countries, they became leaders in those countries. Leaders in surgery, leaders in reconstructive surgery, and leaders in education. And so the ability to do that seemed just like it was something that we had to do, and that's what we did.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Back Table Podcast, your source for all things urology. You can find all previous episodes of our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and at backtable.com.
My name is Ramon Villasoro. I'm a reconstructive urologist at University of Colorado. And it is a great pleasure to introduce my mentor, my father in medicine, and surely the person that has the most influence in my career, Dr. Gerald Jordan, Professor Emeritus of Eastern Virginia Medical School. Dr. Jordan, welcome to Backtable Urology.
It's great to be here with you, Ramon.
All right. So what I find fascinating, Dr. Jordan, is that you pursue three different careers that not only they overlap, but they are somehow connected. Aeronautical engineering as a Navy fighter pilot, medicine as a urologist, and then you became the executive secretary of the American Board of Urology. And I'm very excited to hear about your next adventures as people like you never retire. So my first question to you, Dr. Jordan, what was it like to grow up in El Paso, and how do you think that impacted the choice on your first career, the military career?
Well, El Paso was a very different place than it is now on the news, unfortunately, but it was a great place to grow up. We had ready access to Mexico. We spent half our lives in Mexico, had friends who lived in Mexico, were some of my closest friends. And it was a military town. It had a large Army base, large Air Force base, and for being a little West Texas town, was a markedly very sophisticated town. It was a great place to grow up.
I see. This reminds me of one of the anecdotes when I was in training with you during my fellowship, that you sent me to talk to a patient that only spoke Spanish, and then you entered the room and started speaking Spanish like very fluently and say, When you never told me that you spoke Spanish, you made me struggle with English for so many years, and now I figured out that you know Spanish.
Well, I'll tell you a little story. When my parents went up to speak with one of my teachers, and in El Paso, we never wore a shirt. I mean, I was tanned dark all through the year. My teacher asked my mother, who was from a very sophisticated family in Canada, she asked her if English was spoken in the home, and... And that's because I think I was speaking at that time with a bit of a Latino accent.
I can see that. And talking about that time in your childhood, with your father being a physician, a general surgeon, was that something that made you at some point in your life think about medicine?
My dad was actually one of the first surgeons in West Texas, and he trained in Baltimore. He was very well recognized in the community. And I was interested in science and doing things like that, so oftentimes I could go in the operating room and watch him operate and those kind of things. But coming from Canada, he was very sensitive to the issues of socialized medicine, and in many ways he talked me out of going into medicine as opposed to going into medicine.
That's interesting. And I know, because you and I have known each other for so long, that you were into sports as a young individual, so... Is that what made you think about the military, or what was it that prompted you to join the military?
Well, actually, I was interested in sports, and my sister had married a Naval Academy graduate. He realized my sports interest and thought, well, maybe he might be interested in going to the Naval Academy. So I was contacted by a couple of the coaches at the Naval Academy, and they asked me if I wanted to submit an application and go through the process to go. And I really, at that point, didn't understand what the Naval Academy really was. that just kind of kept going and kept going. And finally, I got an appointment to the Naval Academy. Sounded like a great deal. You go to school and somebody pays you to go. So I thought, this is perfect.
I see. So, and when during your training in the Naval Academy, you thought about medicine then?
Medicine was always a little bit in the back of my mind, but at the Naval Academy, when I was there, you couldn't go into medicine from the Naval Academy, which was different than the other military academies. They all had allowed some of their graduates to go into medicine. And this was before the era of the military medical school, which is in Washington, D.C. So you basically couldn't go into medicine. So it was something I had filed well back into the back of my head and really wasn't even a consideration.
One of the stories that I like of your training in the military is that you managed to get flying wings from all three branches of the military. Tell us, how is that possible?
Well, some people would say I'm a slow learner, but anyway, going back, when I graduated from the academy, my date getting into a flight school class was delayed. So I had some time, and so I went to a justice school, and then I still had time. And so I thought, well, I'm going into aviation, and I may have to jump out of that thing someday. Maybe I need to learn how to land. And so the Army was very kind, and they allowed me to go to their paratrooper school at Fort Benning. And so I actually went there, qualified, got my wings, and then actually stayed there for a while on the cadre before I could go on and get into my flight school class.
Okay, so that's your Army flight wings, right? And then, of course, at the Navy, when you became a Navy pilot, you got your Navy wings. And how did you get your Air Force wings?
I went to medical school in San Antonio, and the Air Force's Institute of Aviation Sciences, I think they called it, it was at Brooke Air Force Base in San Antonio. And I ended up with some time at the end, time that I had to take classes, but I didn't have any classes that I had to take. And I realized that maybe I could go and learn how to be a flight surgeon. So I went down, spoke to the head of the school, and ended up the three of us, all of us ex-military, went down, and we went to flight surgeon school, and we all qualified to get our wings.
Well, then you became a Navy fighter pilot, and I know you did some tours in Vietnam flying F-8 fighters, right? And I remember you telling me that despite how much you loved those aircrafts, you knew that after that, that would sit for you. You did not want it to be even an instructor or a commercial pilot. Is that correct?
Well, I think everybody that learned to fly in the military either thought about staying in the military and flying or going into commercial aviation, but neither of those were really very attractive. Certainly flying in the military at the end of Vietnam was difficult because they had ratcheted back so far after Vietnam that a lot of the jobs were basically nothing more than flying desks. And so I was at the time the admin officer of the squadron, and my assistant passed me a sheet that said that I could get a scholarship to go to medical school. And I came home and talked to my wife, Patty, who thought I was crazy at the time. But not long after that, I was accepted into medical school, and off we went.
And we all thanks for that decision, Dr. Jordan, yes. But going back to you coming back from Vietnam, and I love the story that you told me that you experienced firsthand the creation of Top Gun, right, the famous flight school. Can you tell us a little bit of that story?
Oh, yeah, I can probably tell you more than you really want to know. But what happened in Vietnam is there were a lot of things that we didn't understand going into Vietnam, and one of them was not how to be able to fight the aircraft that the Vietnamese were flying. And they were flying MiGs, the MiG-17 and the MiG-21. They're very good aircraft, but very different in design than the aircraft we had, which was the F-4 and the F-8. We lost a lot of pilots early on in that war because they didn't know how to fight the MiGs. Top Gun was basically a program that was actually called the Fighter Weapons School, and it was designed to teach pilots who had learned the wrong way to fly to fight MiGs, the right way to fight MiGs. And it changed the whole concept of what's called aircraft combat maneuvering. It was a very informal program that was set up, and it was three squadrons at the air station in Miramar that sent pilots, and they initiated the criteria and the program for retrofitting pilots to fly against MiGs. And it basically changed from horizontal warfare, and we can talk about that sometime later because it's not important, to a new concept, which was vertical warfare. And in short, in horizontal warfare, he who could get slowest and still keep the aircraft under control would win. In vertical warfare, he who stayed fastest and didn't give up his speed eventually was going to get the shot. And a very different concept, and that was really where it was. Top Gun was actually a joke. The F-8 was the last of the gunfighters, last airplane to have integral guns mounted in it. And we always taunted the F-4 drivers that they didn't really have anything to shoot because they didn't have any guns in their aircraft. And so one night, after having a lot of fun, we decided that we'd play a little joke on them. And the little trailer that everybody briefed in, we went and painted over the door Top Gun trailer. And we thought that the F-4 guys, that we'd kind of get into their knickers a bit with that. And then we had a guy who was a very good artist who put there was kind of an infatuation with black cats among fighter pilots. And so he came up with this thing, which at some point I think was adopted as a patch of a black cat with two pistols blowing the smoke off the end of the barrels. And we thought our F-4 colleagues would be very put out that this was on that. And as it turned out, they loved it and the name was born.
I see. I love the story, and I'm happy that most people can listen to it because I find it fascinating. All right, so coming back to your medical career, when did you know that you wanted to be a urologist, and was there a person or a situation that influenced that decision?
Well, I really thought I wanted to be a general surgeon. My dad was a general surgeon, and I really loved surgery. I knew I didn't want to be an internist or something like that. The problem was at that time is that general surgery, and I learned this from the surgeons who had trained at where I went to medical school, a lot of general surgery was being taken away from them. So subspecialties were expected to do all of that kind of surgery. And a lot of the general surgeons really were doing nothing but hernias and gallbladders and that kind of stuff. And I thought, well, I sure spent a lot of hours learning how to do a lot of other things. I had some friends who went into urology, a lot of friends, in fact, out of my class. They basically told me a bit about urology because I hadn't taken a rotation in urology in medical school. And basically, you know, urologists were doing continent diversion, and they were doing everything that they basically were taught to do. And I thought, well, that kind of sounds like the right way to go. And so that's when I decided I was going to go into urology.
Right. Your med school was at the University of Texas San Antonio, correct? And
correct.
From there, you did your urology residency at Portsmouth Naval Hospital because you were still in active duty.
That's,
is that correct?
That's right.
And do you have any anecdote during your years as a urology resident like that is remarkable?
Well, one thing about my residency program is that we had to do 6 months of internal medicine because the chairman of that program thought that that would make us better doctors. And I think it did, but it also convinced me that I didn't want to be an internist. So it committed me more to basically going into urology. The program at the Portsmouth Naval Hospital was a best-kept secret. It was a busy hospital. It was the second busiest military hospital in the nation at that point in time. I believe that's a correct statement. We were just busy all the time. I really thought I had found my home until I did a rotation over in Norfolk at this institute that was doing reconstructive urology or genitourinary reconstructive surgery. And when I went over there for my rotation over there, I actually realized I'd found my home.
Interesting. So that's how you decided to continue your training in reconstructive urology with the legendary Divine, Charles Divine?
It was. And actually, the program in Norfolk was certainly Charles Divine and Pat Divine were very prominent in that, but also was the affiliation with the plastic surgeon and the surgeon that most people knew was Charlie Horton. And they introduced the concept that, yes, plastic surgeons and urologists had different skills. But the other thing was that they had different brains. They thought about things in a different way. They could see a problem and they would come up with a different problem depending on whether they were a plastic surgeon or a urologist. And then the two working together could work out what was the best solution. And I think that at the time, that really was not a concept that was well appreciated. And I think it certainly made me a better surgeon. And I think it made reconstructive surgery or genitourinary reconstructive surgery a better subspecialty.
This is very interesting because I remember listening to the episode where Jill Buckley interviews Dr. McEnint, and he says something similar about him working very closely to the general surgeons his time in San Francisco. You think combination of specialties makes results better?
I do. With Jack was at San Francisco General. He did basically got called in on almost all of the genital and urinary trauma. He was with the trauma surgeons all the time. And I know Jack felt that that made him a much more capable surgeon. He was very capable. He trained in the Army, but I think that he thought that that made him better.
Yeah, I love that part of the story on his podcast. All right, so in the early 80s, now that we mentioned Dr. McEnint, there were four renowned centers for reconstructive urology, three on the East Coast and the one in the West where Dr. McEnint was. So as you, as a new partner at the reconstructive center in Norfolk and as a junior faculty at Eastern Virginia Medical School, what was it like to experience the advancements of genitourinary reconstruction? And about the relationship with the late Leonard Zinman, Dr. McEnint, Dr. Webster in those days?
Well, the nice thing about reconstructive surgery is it was a small community and we all liked each other. And we liked each other because we were all friends. We realized that we all did things a little bit different. So we learned from each other. When we had problems, we talked with each other. So I regard Jack and Lenny and George were some of my best friends. And it was not infrequent for me to call them or them to call me.
Do you think that was the beginning of the GURS because of that collegiate relationship you had to each other?
I think it was. The GURS was kind of founded on the concept that a lot of conferences are basically just lectures. And the concept of some of the societies, and in particular the genitourinary surgeons, was that all of the presentations were critiqued and they were discussed. And so GURS was really designed with the idea that different specialties don't think alike, but put all of those specialties in a room, you can get a great discussion. That was the first thing. So we had pediatric urologists, we had gynecologists, we had gynecology oncologists in the room, and we had plastic surgeons in the room. And so it was that discussion atmosphere, all of us dedicated to genitourinary reconstruction, that was the founding of GURS.
That organization, as you know, sustained the time. We're very happy that you thought about funding that with your colleagues at that time.
Well, let me correct. I wish I had been instrumental in the concept, but the concept was basically Charles Devine's concept. And I would agree with you. I think it was brilliant.
Now, I want to talk about something that is very close to my heart, which is global surgical education, something that I got an inspiration from you. And you, because you were always involved in surgical education globally and experienced the birth of important nonprofit organizations dedicated to urological humanitarianism, such as IBU-Med, Physician for Peace, SAFE. So anything that you could tell us about your involvement or your participation with this, or how you experienced the creation of these organizations?
Well, the organizations were really created because for a lot of aspects of genitourinary surgery, there was focal expertise, but not generally available to the people in general. And so they were designed. So Physicians for Peace was designed actually initially to go over, and where the name came from, to go over and to operate, undo some of the travesties of the atmosphere in the Middle East. And it has since changed a bit, and I think it made changes that needed to be made. But Peace was really the brainchild of Charlie Horton initially. I think that now what Peace does, and I think that, in fact, your involvement with Peace and Jessica's involvement and the growing of the fellowship program and those kind of things is wonderful. And then there was a lot of the SIU became very interested in global surgery, and Kurt fortunately got the bug with that and has been very involved with that. And then there was Catherine, who recognized the need for a lot of pediatric surgery and the issue of one trip to show people how to do it, one trip to come back and make sure they learned how to do it. The next trip was to go someplace else and train them.
And that's when you and I talked many times how Kurt took this IVU Med organization funded by Catherine DeVries to the next level, right? Expanding that into different countries and expanding into adult urology.
Absolutely. Yeah. Kurt, when he got to SIU, he became their director of education at one point, and that was a major focus for SIU. And interesting, it was a focus you wondered why they hadn't thought of it years before, but they hadn't.
And when you think about your years as a fellowship director at EVMS to train foreign urologists in the arts of genital urinary reconstruction, was that part of your dreams to expand the subspecialty to underserved areas of the world, or it just happened?
Well, it sort of just happened. We basically were a two-year fellowship, so one thing is that we weren't as appealing to U.S. graduates. They'd already thought they'd spent plenty of time in training, and spending another 2 years really didn't match a lot of their plans, although we did train some very notable graduates, both from Canada and the U.S., who were willing to spend those 2 years. But the foreign graduates were more than happy to come and spend 2 years with us. We were the only fellowship that actually taught both male and female genitourinary reconstructive surgery. And what we realized as we started doing this is that when we returned our fellowship graduates back to their native countries, they became leaders in those countries, leaders in surgery, leaders in reconstructive surgery, and leaders in education. And so the ability to do that seemed just like it was something that we had to do, and that's what we did.
Very fascinating. So around 2010, you started retiring from clinical urology, and eventually you became part of the American Board of Urology, Board of Trustees, and eventually as well the Executive Secretary, right? So this is your third career that I'm fascinated about. So how was that process around that time, Dr. Turnerman?
Well, going into the board atmosphere is very different because the whole goal of that is standard setting for education, standard setting in the community, and then being able to go to the public and say that those standards made sense. And it's a very deliberate process. And for me, it was a very fulfilling process to be in meetings constantly in a room of 12 people, every single one of them leaders at their institutions, with one goal in mind, and that is to be able to come up with programs that we could go to the public and say, your urologist is a good surgeon and a good urologist.
Yeah, so I was about to ask you if you had something very important that you took from those more than 15 years that you served at the ABU, right?
I did.
Yeah. And do you think the AVU will be able to adjust to the needs of the country with this shortage of urologists that we are facing? How do you think they're going to manage that?
Well, the AVU's job is to be able not to educate urologists, and that really is very skillfully done by organizations like the AUA, but to actually come up with criteria where urologists, when they get out of training, can actually realize where they may not have kept up as well in some instances, or just want to get better in some instances. And that's a major challenge to be able to do that. And again, it's not to make urologists happy, it's to make the public happy. It's to make the public trust urologists without, however, being too burdensome for urologists, so that urologists can't get out and earn a living, and also then be able to have time with their family. And interestingly, while urology in the past was kind of, I think, recognized as one of the funner aspects of surgery, it's now recognized as an aspect of surgery that's very difficult and actually wearing on many urologists. And I think that that's something that the board's not going to be able to address. But we are having people not go into urology now because the urology practice is becoming too stressful. At least that's what I'm being told.
With me training outside the United States, doing my residency out of the United States, I had to go through the alternative pathway for the American Board of Urology to be board certified. And when I applied for this, and you're very aware of that, I had to become a full professor at an accredited ACGME training program. But now I heard that they removed that requirement. Still, they want individuals to pursue 7 years in an ACGME institution. Do you think that this is one of the strategies trying to capture more international urologists?
Well, I'm removed enough that I probably can't try and second guess the board. I can tell you why 7 years was picked. And that is that in a 7-year period, what it meant was the person who had trained in a foreign medical environment would be under the U.S. environment and the U.S. scrutiny for a period equivalent to a residency and a fellowship. So that's where the 7 years came from. And it was really, that was the mindset that established that criteria. And whether that was absolutely perfect or not, I certainly can't say. But I do know that we certified some very talented people, you being one of them. And it's a process that worked, and people then went on to become very productive as teachers in a number of academic institutions. So why they have decided to modify it, I would say the way the board works is that it's for good reason. But it's not up to me to try and second-guess their reasons.
Well, let me tell you, Dr. Jordan, this has been an amazing journey, and I'm so privileged that I have been trained by you and that you are in my life. And I would love to hear what is it that fills your heart and motivates you these days, and what is next in your life? Because like I said, people like you never retire. You have something in mind for sure.
Well, there's been a lot that's happened since I, quote, retired that have taken up my time. But certainly, I am enjoying more time with my family down here, and my sons both live on the Outer Banks for a major part. Our grandchildren are down here. We're meeting new friends down here. I'm in an environment where there's a lot of fishing and hunting. So if I end up not doing anything much more than that, most people would feel like very blessed to just be able to do that.
Well, as long as I continue practicing urology, I will always drag you into the field, so you can be assured of that.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you, Ramon.
So getting to the final of this interview, do you have any closing remarks or a message that you want to send to the young urologists out there?
Oh, well, what I would say is urology, for me, became a great friend, and it allowed me to make some really good friends. It's a good specialty. The patients are nice people, and I hope that urology is something that they will give a look to. And if they want the really fun part of urology, then look into reconstructive surgery, because it's a lot of fun.
All right, Dr. Jordan, thank you so much for this privilege to interview, and thank you for Backtable Urology for giving me this opportunity to interview my mentor and, like I said, my father in medicine.
Well, you're certainly welcome, Ramon. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend.
If you have any questions or comments, DM us at _backtable on Instagram, LinkedIn, or Twitter.
Backtable is hosted by Aditya Bagrodia
and Jose Silva.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon, with support from
Josh McWhirter,
Aaron Bowles, Nick Shellcross,
Josh Spencer.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz.
Social media and PR by Chi Ding.
Administrative support provided by Jamila Kinnebrew.
Thanks again for listening, and see you next week.